system, starting with quarterly financial reports. Brenda.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone. I am going to start the first quarter financial review by looking at the bridge chart. We began the year with a preliminary net position of $1.84 billion. Investment-related transactions during the first quarter increased the net position by $77 million. Benefits and operations-related transactions reduced the net position by almost $30 million, and we ended the quarter with a net position of $1.89 billion. And that's up $47 million since the beginning of the year. Next, I'm briefly going to discuss some highlights from the financials. So if you'll turn the page, we're going to look at the combined statements of fiduciary net position. This report compares the results from March of 2023 to December, to our preliminary results from December 2022. The first section is investments. As we look at total investment value at March 31st, it was $1.8 billion, and that compares to $1.75 billion at the end of December, or an increase of $58 million. This increase is primarily related to the market changes in equities and fixed income, along with some dispositions in real assets during the first quarter. As we move down the page and we look at cash and cash equivalents, we see that cash and cash equivalents decreased by $4 million during the quarter. $15 million was rebalanced into equities, and that was mostly offset by cash that we received during the first quarter. As we move to the next page, this is the statement of changes in fiduciary net position, and it compares the 3 months ended March of 2023 with March of 2022. The first section is contributions. City and member contributions increased by $1.2 million when compared to last year. As we look at city contributions, they increased by $465,000. Notable this year, the floor decreased from $6.043 million per pay period down to $5.812 million per pay period. So this change has effectively eliminated the floor, and we're receiving contributions based purely on comp pay. If we look at the member contributions, they have increased by $778,000 over the last quarter due to increased salaries and staff levels. Regular member contributions increased by $921,000. However, there was an offset from a decline in drop contributions and employee buybacks. However, the employee headcount has increased by 143 when compared to March of 2022. As we move down the page and we look at net investment income, it increased by almost $167 million year over year. And that is primarily related, again, to the change in the public markets during this first quarter. As we continue down the page and we look at benefits paid to members, they increased by $1.7 million year over year. Service pensions to members increased by $1.1 million, and survivor benefits increased by $616,000. New retirements at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver in the increase in benefits paid to members. Are there any questions about the financials? Kelly?
Okay, so the contribution report is the next item, and I'm not sure you've all been here. I can't remember when people joined, but this meeting is required in the statute, and we're required to report on the health and performance of the pension system. In the May meeting, there's not a lot other than what you already see in your normal meetings, but we're required to have this meeting. In the meeting in 6 months, we schedule that one to coincide with when we get the actuarial evaluation. So that meeting has a little more meat in it than this one, but it's why it's structured this way, in case any of you wondered. So I will just talk about the contribution report. It is in line with the contributions report that you've seen for the last couple of years. This is the May report. It's based on March data. There were three pay periods in March that are included in this report. As of the date, the last pay period in March, there was police was under by 205 employees and fire was over by 122. So in total, the number of employees anticipated in the hiring plan was under by 83 people. As far as the contributions go, Brenda talked about the floor, and as you know, the floor declined, so it's not really playing a part right now. The floor for March was $17.4 million. Contributions based on actual pay, $18.4 million, so no contribution from the floor. Nothing is surprising here. I do expect that the number of police officers will drop, maybe significantly in the next few months. We're seeing a lot of retirements, but also it looks like they're struggling more with their recruit classes. We had a recruit class that we went out to last month that they originally were only going to have 12 people in. By the time they had the class, they actually had 17, but they typically lose about a third of the people in those classes. I've never seen a class that small that they've done, so we'll see what happens with their numbers going forward. Any questions about the contribution report?
Why the increase in retirement that you anticipate?
They tend to happen. I mean, they go in cycles, and I think it has to do with, you know, 25 years ago, whenever they had big recruit classes at that time, and people kind of moved through the system together, it seems like. And they have implemented a retention incentive for people between 28 years of service, well, what, 28 years of service, which will keep some of the people on a couple more years, I think. But we've gotten a lot of phone calls in the last couple of weeks for retirement. That's all.
Anything else? Okay.
No.
So what we would like to do is to adjourn this required public meeting. Can I have a motion to adjourn? Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. So that meeting is adjourned. And now we're going to go to the regular meeting and kind of follow the normal protocols that we do. The first thing we'd like to do is have a moment of silence for those people that are no longer with us. Thank you. And we have the consent agenda. First thing we look at is the minutes from last month. Any comments or questions on those? Okay, can I have a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Second. Where did you appear from? Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Consent agenda. Kelly, anything you want to flag?
No, nothing unusual.
Okay. Can we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries. Public comment, chance two. Anyone like to say anything?
Again, we have some new people that five-star on the phone.
Okay. All right. Moving on, the next item are the quarterly and monthly reports that we already did, so we don't need to do those again. And the next after that would be item C4, a report on the audit committee meeting that we met before this meeting. And the system has retained New BDO again. We're thrilled to have them. They've been excellent partners. I really do want to take this moment to thank them that we're in an environment today with accounting firms where they have a shortage of the staff, and so we look at kind of the overall supply and demand in the marketplace. There's entities like ours that cannot find competent accounting firms to partner with, and so we really do appreciate what they do. There's a modest increase in fees. There's some additional market-based language on indemnification and limits of liability that we work through. The main thing we always talk about with them is communication, that if there is any potential issues, that we get ahead of it earlier rather than later. And they're very, very complimentary of staff, and I don't like to say the word staff like the names. Brenda, they're very complimentary of you, so and others. So that's kind of what we talked about in the audit committee meeting. Nancy, you or Mondo, have anything else to add?
No, they've just been very transparent, very communicative with us on the engagement letter changes, on the fee structures. It's been a very, very pleasant business relationship.
Okay. So, Jill, given what we said, you can't say anything about nice things about us now. No, you can't say every she and I did the same shortcut to get here this morning. Jill, if you'd like to go over just the overall audit plan.
Okay. I don't know if my slides are
keep going.
Okay.
Keep going.
Page 36. There we go. Okay. Thank you all for having us here. I want to acknowledge Matt Liu, who is here with me as well. Matt is the senior manager on the engagement, and Matt and I have both been on this engagement since we were first retained by the system. So Matt's worked his way up from being a senior through a manager and getting to senior manager, so he's been with us the entire time as well. Moving into our responsibilities, just to remind you all, I know we've been through all this before, but our responsibility is to ensure the financial statements are free of material misstatements. So we design our procedures to ensure that there are no material misstatements within your financial statements. Our audit strategy considers several different things as we go through planning how we are going to approach the engagement. We do have a higher focus on those higher risks of misstatement, looking at valuations, the actuarial reports, the things that take a lot of estimation and go into that. So we do use specialists on the actuarial side as well. And when it comes down to the investment valuation, depending on which ones we're looking at, we may get our valuation experts involved to take a look at some of the things we're going through there. We also consider, as we're planning the audit, the inherent risk, like I said, within the different financial statement areas, any developments in the industry, what we're seeing, any changes in internal controls from the system, anything like that, we'll bring that in when we're planning our audit. When I get down to the areas that come into scope for our audit, fraud risk is there, and again, I mentioned this to the audit committee, and I'll say it here as well. This is not that we've identified fraud within the system. This is something that is required in the auditing standards. I have to consider fraud risk in any of my audits. So that is something we do focus on. We also look at the system of internal control. We do not give an opinion on internal controls. We haven't been engaged to audit internal controls, but we need to understand the control environment in order to plan our procedures appropriately. If anything does come to our attention as it is related to controls, those will be reported to management and to the audit committee. Additionally, we focus on the actuary evaluation. That's a huge piece of our audit and takes experts to work with us to get through that. We also consider compliance with plan documents. That includes eligibility, contributions, benefit payments, and such. So those are big pieces of the testing. And then, of course, investments, including existence and valuation and investment income as well. So those are the big chunks that take more time as we go through that. We also do consider related parties, again, in every engagement to ensure that if there are related parties being used, they were appropriately approved by the audit committee or the board, and that any significant transactions are disclosed. And then we will also go through and make sure any disclosures are appropriate for any other accounting matters, contingencies, and things such as that. So those are the big highlights, the areas of the audit. The pages after this go through those areas in detail. This is similar to what you've seen before. It has our considerations, and it has our audit approach. High level. Sometimes we might add additional things in there if something comes up in our testing, but by and large, this is our overall approach. And so I will not read all of these to you. Our overall audit timeline, this is something, you know, we work with Brenda and Kelly on to make sure we're scheduled appropriately. We start planning and doing our work here in May and through June. Typically by the end of June, we're done with the majority of our testing. In July and August, there may be a few things coming, and obviously we do acknowledge and understand that you are at the mercy of some of your general partners on some of your investments, so we might have to wait for some audits. Brenda is always very forthcoming with what the delays may be and what that looks like, so we can plan appropriately for that. So this timeline could get extended, but by and large, the majority of the work should be done here by the end of this summer. Independent.
What were the dates that we've actually had sign off in the past? I mean, they extend pretty late.
October, November,
just so everybody.
Yeah. And usually we are primarily done, and we're just waiting on a few investments and then the finalization of the actuarial report. So, you know, Matt and I try to manage that as best as we can to make sure that we are still being efficient, and we've got that all closed down. We know what's open. And like I said, Brenda lets us know exactly what timeline is looking like so we can plan ahead. That's the most important thing for us, is to be able to plan ahead and get our staffing on the schedule for when we think we really are going to get it.
When you're waiting for the firms, are you waiting for their year-end report or their actual K-1 or both?
Audit report.
Okay, so their audit and the K-1 and then the evaluations.
Right.
Yeah.
Independence, we are required to be independent of the system, and our engagement letter lines that out, and I do confirm to you all here now as well that BDO is independent of the Dallas Police and Fire Pension System. The next few slides go through just some additional GASB standards that are out there for your consideration, and these have all been discussed with Brenda. I think your accounting team's all aware of all of these that are coming down the pipeline, so we won't go through all of that here. And then the last slides are just some information for you. I'm happy to take any questions.
Good. So thanks for coming by.
Sure.
Brenda, no reason for them to stick around. Yeah. So thanks for coming in. Yeah.
Thank you for having us.
Sure.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item, do we want to do portions in closed session?
Right, but we won't need to go into closed session.
Okay.
So I was just, I'll just talk about
this. Okay, this next issue you can see is benefits over payment. You know, there's certain things we don't have a choice but to address. So this is
something, you know, we, in the course of our years of doing this, we've had all sorts of things that you know, we're compelled to have to address. This is one of them. Just in general, you know, we want to find the most benevolent way to deal with this issue.
Right.
Yeah.
So this issue, it's an instance where we overpaid people their monthly benefit and in some cases their drop benefit also. It came to our attention right before we posted the agenda, and because of the dollar amounts and our policy, we're required to bring it to the board. I've included the policy for your review in here. This is a really complicated issue, so I'm actually not ready to talk. I was hoping I would be ready today to give you my recommendation, but I'm not, so I'll tell you what the issue is, and then you can look forward to talking about it again next month. But the situation happened on the January 15th, 1991 payroll processing, so a very long time ago. What ended up happening is the contributions on that payroll, and actually we found one other payroll even earlier than that, were counted twice in members' accounts. And what that did, even though it's a very small issue, you know, might have been $80 or whatever for contributions, it overstated their average comp, which overstated their benefit, and then some of them joined drop when drop came about, and it overstated their drop. So we are trying to unwind that going all the way back, and a lot of these overpayments are over $40, but $40 a month kind of adds up over time. We can only recover 36 months of overpayment, but there's also the drop consideration. There's some divorces in there. So we're working through that. But next month, I intend to come forward with basically a table that shows the impacts and the recommendations. And I'm thinking my recommendation is going to be different for somebody with a drop account that doesn't have a drop account. So you'll see that again.
Any idea of magnitude, dollars in an aggregate? For 3 years only?
Well, for 3 years only. A lot of, I don't want to guess. I mean, some of them are right around the $10,000 mark, but that's if they have a drop, and everybody's different. So not a lot of dollars. I mean, most of these people are in their upper 70s at this point. A lot of the people that it happened to, we're talking of roughly 10 people right now. It was hundreds that it happened to, but some of them are no longer receiving a benefit because they've passed away, or they didn't retire during that time period where that period would have been in their average calculation. So we've narrowed it down. John's done an excellent job of narrowing, and now they're trying to figure out the impact per person.
So how does that work logistically? Like, if we plan to try to recover that, we're going to go back to them and say, here's what happened, and you overpaid, and you
right.
owe us this money?
So typically, if we have an overpayment, we're required to collect it. I mean, by law, we have to try to collect it. So if I'm thinking my recommendation will be, if they have a drop account, I'm probably going to propose that we try to take all of it out of their drop and reannuitize their drop, which will be the least hurtful. And then going forward, we will have to lower their benefit. And I think most of them will be $40 or $50 that we lower their ongoing benefit. But if they don't have a drop account or they don't want to do that, then we'll have to set up a payment plan to reduce their monthly payment, which is very difficult right now with no COLAs and inflation. We recognize that.
And there's no, like, statute of limitations on something like this?
Well, what happens is we can't go back to 1991 or whenever their benefit was set. Actually, some of them could have been as late as 1995 or 6, we can only go back 36 months. So the way we would approach it is, you were overpaid X, a bigger number. We need to recover this smaller number.
And you're saying it's about 10 people?
We think it's 10 people. Is that, has
roughly.
It changed, John?
No.
Okay.
What does that amount to?
I don't know yet, but we'll bring it back next month with more detail. I was hoping to have it today, but we want to make sure we get good information for you. It's very complicated.
We had something like this a couple of years back, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
That was similar, and we tried to collect it, and We didn't collect at all, I don't think.
Right. I mean, it's unfortunate when these things happen. I mean, they're so random. We do a really good job, I think, of reviewing the contributions when things when people are retiring. I think the system's actually been changed now where that can't happen. You can't have two contributions for the same date, but that was 30 years ago.
How do we even catch something like this that happened 30 years ago? I mean, it's amazing.
Well, what happened was I had asked Brenda's group to look at the refunds because I noticed during the last valuation we had over 400 people that are owed some part of a refund, and to me that seemed like a lot of people. The auditors didn't mind because it's not material, but that's multiple years of people. So I'm like, what's the deal? Why aren't these people coming to get their money? So sometimes people don't. Sometimes they don't follow up. So I asked Brenda to put together a task force to work through that. So I guess it's Brenda's fault. So in doing that, they're saying, why is this person owed this small amount of money? And in researching it, that's where it came up. Yeah.
Okay.
So what were we all doing the day that the mistake was first made 30 years ago?
I just got back from Croatia. They were fighting a war then.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm still in high school.
somebody's going to say they weren't born then.
I was 3 months pregnant. Yeah.
I think Ryan was born.
No, actually, maybe.
So we'll work through that. That's an unfortunate situation. Okay.
Okay. Trustee education and travel.
There, the list of classes is there for you. There's no request, but if anybody's interested, there's still time to register for these text person and speakers classes, so you can let Carol know.
Okay, but do we have any requirements? Don't we have some mandated that
yes.
we have to do? And she's going to let us know when we're...
Yeah, she does let you know.
Okay.
And so I have that here with me if anybody wants to know.
So everyone just be on the lookout for that. Okay. Legislative update. Josh, we're going so fast, but something tells me that we're about to, like in Star Wars, when they go from that hyper speed to the...
Well, appreciate that, that intro, Nick. So with respect to the two bills directly affecting DPSP, Christy mentioned the first bill, the one dealing with the line of duty death. If the bill has passed the House, the bill that passed the House is the one that simply is a prospective increase for future deaths, not including any deaths that occurred prior to September 1st, 2023. The bill is now in the Senate Finance Committee. The bill has not gotten a hearing yet at the committee. Kelly and I, along with Eddie Slate from Hilco, went down a couple of weeks ago to Austin and met with a staffer from Senator Johnson's office to talk about that. So the Senator Johnson is the one who's sponsoring the bill on the Senate side, as well as we had a longer conversation with Senator Huffman, Chief of Staff. Senator Huffman, as some of you may know, was involved with the pension reforms in 2017, both in Houston and Dallas. And so she's very knowledgeable about pensions, pension reform, that type of thing. And I think, you know, I'll remind you that when Eddie and Buddy Jones were in here to give you a legislative update, they did sort of advise that the legislature, and in particular Senator Huffman, is very attuned to pensions and funding levels and things like that. And so I would say that it was a very spirited discussion with Senator Huffman's Chief of Staff. He's very knowledgeable, and there was a very good back and forth with him. It was a longer conversation than we generally have with legislative staff. I think the senator, my understanding is the senator is still considering whether to give the bill a hearing. I think she has a general view, which is, you know, the board has talked about at the time we discussed this, that a plan with our funding level shouldn't be increasing benefits until it's on more solid funding funding footing. And that, and so I think the senator thinks that not just with respect to our plan, but any plan shouldn't be increasing benefits when they're at a funding level of 40% like we're at. So,
did you mention she's the chair of the committee?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize. Yeah, so she, Senator Huffman is the chair of the Finance Committee, so she would ultimately have a say as to whether or not the say as to whether or not the bill would get a hearing. So I do think the senator understands. She is, it's my understanding, she's a very strong supporter of public safety, police, and fire. She has been her whole career, and I think that she's, my understanding is she's very sympathetic to the benefit increase. We did, Kelly and I both made clear to the senator's chief of staff that the board considered this on many occasions. This was not taken lightly in any sense, and that the board felt like it was an important benefit, an important use of trust funds to make sure that these people were paid. So at this point in time, we're still hopeful that, that the senator will allow a hearing on the bill and see if it can get passed through the Senate. There is, everybody concerned has a committee substitute, which we had previously drafted. It has not been introduced yet officially, so it was not introduced on the House side. And the hope is that the committee substitute, which includes including everybody from the past as well as doing it prospectively, the hope is that that would get introduced on the Senate side and then passed on the Senate side and then reconciled with the House bill and become law. But at this point, you know, we don't, just don't know what's going to happen. And obviously time is running out now on the session. So I think it's being considered the best I can describe it, because that's about the length, the extent of our knowledge. Kelly, is there, am I missing something?
No, I mean, we're still pushing it. We did get questions from Senator Huffman's office last week, and I thought that was a good sign. A couple days, lots of follow-up questions. So we'll see.
Yeah.
When does time run out? There's a deadline when they've got to make a decision to have a hearing or not and to pass it.
Yeah, it, I think on the, I'm not a total expert on the rules. On the House side, it's much more formalistic when the committee stops hearing. On the Senate side, it's a little looser about how they can kind of convene a hearing. So I think it's much closer to the end of the session. But I think realistically, within the next week to 2 weeks, we're probably, you know, you're kind of coming up at the end of what the time just runs out. It gets crowded out. So there's a lot of engagement there. There's a lot of understanding. There's a lot of knowledge, which is, you know, both helpful and sometimes maybe not so helpful. But, I mean, it's from my perspective, as much as we've, Kelly and I, have tried to push hard the board's desire here, I do think, just as a citizen of the state of Texas, I am happy to see at least the legislature understanding the issue and considering it. It, you know, in a thoughtful way. So,
have any questions been asked as to what do other plans in Texas have?
They did ask a similar question, not that exact one, but, and I said my understanding is most of them have more. When we had the conversation with Huffman's chief of staff, I did point out that, you know, San Antonio is trying to increase their off-duty death benefit to build above our line of duty death benefit. And, you know, just because you're from one city versus another and one has a better funded plan or not shouldn't matter, but
right.
Don't think
so. Josh, and other peer firms, do they have to go to the state legislature to get this benefit, or are we unique in that?
Other pension systems?
Yeah, the other comparable pension systems in Texas.
Well, I think most of them already have had it in their plan for some period of time.
But say an issue of this magnitude, do most have to go through the state legislature, or are we unique in that?
No, most plans are governed by what are called the 6243 series of plans, the city plans. So the state legislature does control the benefit structure. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think almost every, maybe every police and fire plan is controlled by the state legislature. Some of
the big ones, not the small.
The small ones are well, they're under TELFRA, and that's still the legislature. So some of the municipal plans are not, like the City of Dallas plan is not controlled by the legislature. But I think almost all, if not all, the public safety.
So if the civilians wanted to make a change to their plan, they could do it at the board level.
So they would have, like, and I'll talk about that under another item, but they would have to follow the rules in their governing document, which for the City of Dallas, that's their ordinance. And it lays out, and it would be different for every city.
Okay.
Sometimes it can be board level, sometimes it can be council, sometimes it's an election.
Yeah, I mean, Fort Worth can literally, at a council meeting, change their benefits. Like, on one council meeting, I believe, can change their benefit structure.
Yeah. Essentially, her bigger issue is that the level of funding,
yes,
that we shouldn't add any more cost to it. That's a big one.
That's exactly it.
So it's a philosophical issue for her more than really anything.
Right.
And I think...
Pull it down more like...
Yeah, absolutely. It's philosophical.
Because she's looking at numbers, not the morality of it, you know?
And I think she's... They do not, I think she believes she doesn't want to set a precedent that allowing one system, then another system that's poorly funded comes in with the same request. So I think it's just, it really is. And let me correct myself. That reminds me, Fort Worth is, I think, the one police and fire plan, because that plan is together. Their municipal plan, the police and fire plan are all one and the same plan, and that can get changed by the city council, not by the state legislature. Thank you.
There's a summary, by the way, on the PRB website that you can look at, and it tells you how all plans get changed, if you're curious of the 100 plans in PRB.
And I have not committed to memory. So, if any other questions on the lines of your death bill? The other DPSC bill is the bill on drop. That also passed the House. It's also been assigned to the Finance Committee, and I think it's got a similar, I think there's, you know, clearly a similar concern, even because there is a small cost there as well to that bill. So I think the senator has got a similar concern with respect to the drop bill. So we'll see what happens on both those bills.
What was our official position on that drop bill?
Neutral.
Neutral on the drop bill?
Right. We didn't, the board had indicated you simply follow the City of Dallas on that bill. The only other piece of legislation I would mention briefly is the Senate Bill 1446. It's the bill dealing with ESG issues. It passed the Senate. It was at the Pensions Committee yesterday discussed. It was not voted on. I've described it previously, basically two aspects. One is dealing with how investment managers manage investments and how they can't be, it's got to be solely financial concerns and not sort of political, social, ESG type of concerns. The second piece deals with proxy voting. There's a lot of ideas floating around. There's a lot of discussion around it. The state systems have weighed in, although some more than others. It's obviously a very highly political issue. I think Ken has been involved from the TexVerse perspective, being on the TexVerse board and the legislative committee. TexVerse has been active in trying to get some of the pieces changed, that because it does put more of a burden on pension systems, both from a monetary as well as time perspective, to deal with the reporting requirements. There's also discussion about whether it will reduce the amount of managers that might be willing to manage money because of the requirements. That's not clear, and it's not clear how the bill is going to come out. It does sound like something is going to pass, although we've heard that there may be changes as late as on the floor, the House floor. So nobody knows how it's going to – we just continue to monitor it and see where it goes. If we get asked a question by the PRB or something, we answer it. But other than that, the board just taking the previous direction that we would just remain neutral on it and just try to see where it goes and minimize to the extent we can any additional burden on the pension system.
Two of our legislative committee members for Texpers testified yesterday at 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't got any update. They said they would provide updates as it comes along, so I don't know how that hearing, how that testimony went, but hopefully we'll get a report. I'll get a report today maybe on it.
Sounds like it's left pending and the vote is going to be close to get it out of committee.
Yeah. Well, luckily, one of our legislative members is also the executive director of El Paso's pension system, so he understands the burden that will have on his system
yeah.
to do all that extra reporting on property. So he testified yesterday.
That's it for legislation. Sorry to bog it down.
Ryan.
All
right.
So,
solve all of our problems. It's a great portfolio update.
Try.
So, go ahead.
So we have a short investment agenda. We'll get the portfolio update, and then we'll do a review on the timber portfolio close session. So as always, liquidation of private market assets is primary focus. We've gotten $40 million back here to date. Most of that is coming from AEW with the Campbell Square office building and the J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund. Reminder, we put the safety reserve into drawdown mode in March of 2022. With some of the proceeds we received, we had $60 million to redeploy or consider redeploying last month. We put half of those into the global equity portfolio with majority going into the passive ACWI IMI global equity mandate and then $5 million into Eastern Shore U.S. small cap. We held the other half of it back in the safety reserve. So we put $10 million into IRM because we had quite a bit of cash and then $20 million stayed in the cash allocation. So just since we put the safe reserve into drawdown mode 14 months ago, we've had $190 million of proceeds to consider redeploying. $85 million of that has gone back into the global equity portfolio, while we've held back $105 in the safe reserve. So that's extended the coverage period from what would have been, you know, the safe reserve running out in September of 23 to pinning it through 9 months further to June of 24. Consultant search, so we got just a quick recap. We issued RFPs to 9 different firms. We've narrowed that down to 5 semi-finalist firms. In mid-April, staff had interviews with those 5 firms. Last week, we had a meeting of the subcommittee on Monday to review where we're at there and recommendations going forward. The plan is to conduct in-person interviews between the subcommittee and some the finalist firms in mid-June, and then bring a recommendation back to the board in July on how to proceed.
Are there 2 finalists that we're looking at? I mean,
yes.
Is one looking at a special private equity, or what's the thinking
so
at this point?
So we're trying to assess kind of current consultants, private market capabilities as compared to using a specialist in that area.
So are we sort of saying that Makita, then we're sort of considering for the general consulting, or is there somebody competing for that?
No, the discussion was, you know, they've done a good job on general side. They're, you know, 85% of the public assets have been are new in the last 6 years. There's not a whole lot of changes expected or needed on the public side. So really, it's kind of what to do and who to use on the private side.
Okay,
I think it's very relevant, the magnitude of it, and you know, I can see how sometimes people can spend an outsized amount of time and focus on privates because it's more of a broad, like that Bennigan's menu that's, you know, 15 pages long versus, you know, on the public side, you have a pretty short menu. You might have some choices, but it's a little more condensed. And so I think that's relevant, and we're letting kind of the process work out, but I just think we need to be mindful of, you know, how big is the private portfolio of new decisions going to be, and therefore what does that mean in terms of getting advice. So,
yeah. And we're probably, you know, best case, the end of this year, maybe some new private equity commitments, you know, when stuff comes back. Real estate's probably sometime into 24. What we're talking about is fairly, you know, small and basic at first. So any comments from any of the subcommittee members that are here on that?
Would you, if let's say hypothetically, if we use Makeda, is there a way to bifurcate the time limit for each generalist side or specialty side on the private, only because we could review the privates again as opposed to putting it all together again? Do you see what I'm saying?
In the contract. In the contract.
In the contract.
Basically two different contracts.
Yes, because,
yeah, I'm sure.
Because I think that, you know, if we're okay with the generalists, if the privates become more complicated, I think we should revisit that part of it.
Well, we haven't made a decision on whether or not Makeda's going to continue.
I'm just saying, hypothetically.
Talking about, you know, what the private market portfolio looks like in year one through three, you know, it could evolve and play will evolve over time. So,
do we have a task force, a subcommittee on this?
There's a subcommittee that's made up of three board members, three IAC members.
Yeah.
That's who we had the meeting with on Monday. That's who will interview the two firms in mid-June. Based on that meeting, we'll bring something back to the board to consider in July. So, I think we can kind of, after the interview meeting, we can kind of go through all those considerations and figure out how the best way to proceed.
Again, we're just interviewing for the private equity side, really, effectively.
Correct.
Okay. So, who are the board members that are on the subcommittees?
Tina, Nancy, Ken, and then from the IAC is Tom, Rakesh, and Ryan Bailey. Okay, so moving on from that, year-to-date returns through April 30th, up 4.75% for the overall portfolio, up 7% market ex cash, which is just over 2/3 of the assets. Looking at...
Hey, Ryan. Ryan, sorry.
Yeah.
Ryan, sorry. It's Michael Brown. I just want to ask one last question. I heard the dialogue about the private equity search. We have not, is this correct, that we have not had the discussion about strategy with private equity as it relates to secondaries or direct new investments? This is only to select the managers, and the managers would help us direct that strategy.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Whatever consultant we use on private markets would come in and kind of outline big picture strategy, then kind of go into pacing plan, how do we want to allocate, you know, how complex do we want to be, do we want to do a core satellite approach, do we want to do a direct approach, you know, secondary fund of funds, all those considerations were kind of, we're having discussions with them about kind of what they think that could look like, but it's kind of too early to figure out exactly what that will be. So that's kind of...
Okay.
Job one once we make a hire.
Okay, thank you.
And isn't it fair to say that if the board does go ahead and brings on a specialist, let's say, that capability would be much broader than just private equity? It would include real
estate. Yeah,
yeah.
So we're
infrastructure. And
what we're talking about for the private markets right now is 5% to private equity, which is about $100 million. 5% to private real estate, another $100 million. And then we have the ag portfolio, which is another 5% that's currently allocated. So it's kind of oversight of the current ag portfolio that will evolve over time. And then the new allocations of $100 million each as money comes back. So, yeah, it's private equity, private real estate. I think the other considerations that, like, private debt's the one area in our asset allocation that we don't really have an allocation to. So we need to figure out, do we want to do that? Do we want to do that within private equity? Do we want to add allocation longer term to that space? So that's kind of the one hole I think we have right now.
Yeah. But these are just targets, and currently we have some assets in those buckets already.
Yeah.
Okay.
We are over, I'll show the slide in a minute. We're quite over-allocated to both of those asset classes. And, the, you know, the 15% target that we have was set originally in 2018, when we were at 45% in private markets, is just kind of a marker down the road, and we're getting closer to those goals.
I would just add that when we re-enter this world, you know, I wasn't around last time, but my sense is there was a lot of words that people didn't understand and concepts and a lot of, you know, all that kind of stuff, and that we all owe it to ourselves. There's different levels of knowledge of some of these private asset classes. not, but that we really need to be collectively educated. You know, Ryan, you always pass over kind of what I think is one of the most profound positive accomplishments, the liquidation of the private market. I mean, just think of how much time we spent on that in the last 6 or 7 years. That's the remnant of people not really knowing what they got into way back when. Tell me if I have this correctly, but we have generated proceeds from liquidating private assets, which has been in excess of our negative cash outflow on distributions since the end of 2017.
Yeah, the last 5 years we've covered 113% of benefit outflows.
Yeah,
private
so just think of all the issues and problems we had if we also had that problem, that we were having to dig into the meat of the public portfolio in order to pay current distributions. But instead, and also, you know, it's almost like one of those fish where, like, the first people eat the obvious meat, then you have other people that kind of are able to pick out, you know, more meat from, you know, near the bones and all that. A lot of these privates were already, the easy ones were monetized prior to the end of 2017, right?
Yeah, we sold 22 private equity funds, all the marketable stuff.
So since the end of 2017, it's been stuff that wasn't obvious, and it's covered the negative outflow. So I really think that's one of the great accomplishments of this team over the last, you know, several years. And like I said, just think about if we had to discuss, you know, what we're going to sell every meeting in order to fund benefits. We haven't really had to do that.
And it's the cash flow situation will flip on two fronts because we'll be allocating new money into private assets and also having to figure out kind of where are we pulling money to fund the benefit outflows.
Yeah.
And the other added nuance is what we sign and agree to prior to even making the investment with the agreement with these managers. I mean, we just, in some cases, just allow way too much latitude.
You private equity people are really good at sticking it to us, so we'll be a lot more prepared to deal with people of your level.
Ryan, are you seeing a lot of like pitch decks for private credit or distressed credit right now?
I mean, there's like we're not talking to a ton of people because, you know, we're still a year away from being in the market. But I know me and Tom were at a conference 2 weeks ago. But we were told it's the golden age of private credit. So. From a private credit.
Yeah, there's a lot
it's
of
the golden age, you said.
Yeah, the golden age of private credit.
Oh, but there's a lot of like really top tier big name PE firms that are raising distressed credit funds and looking at that. I don't know how we think about, you know, a very programmatic way to come back into this, but also kind of potentially being opportunistic if something like that comes along in the next 6 months, to be able to take advantage of that. But just curious if you're seeing any decks from folks, because there are a lot of people mobilizing right now.
Yeah, I mean, like I think this window, if there is one in the next 6 months, we'll miss that because we're just too over-allocated right now, and it's going to be more, you know, 12 or 18 months from now. We've got to figure out if we are doing private credit and how. But, yeah, there's been a lot of capital raise. I think the other considerations, you know, if we could earn yielding 10% of public fixed income, should you even be messing with private credit?
Well, yeah, I guess, okay, that's fair. I guess I would lump all of that together. General debt fixed income right now, right? But how do we think about that, though, right? Because if we've got long-run return objectives and we're behind so far and that window emerges, right, are there ways that we can be more nimble to be able to step into
something? That's kind of a board decision that I would say that we know we're not going to be able to invest our way out of the hole, so, you know, the tactical opportunities, we haven't, you know, done that in the past or the last 5 years, so I'm sure there's opportunities out there, but I'm not sure it's prudent to, you know.
Another big factor is our liquidity issue. We're $10 million a month negative cash flow. How much could you afford to put in those with that kind of negative cash flow? I mean, I think that's all going to be boiled into the strategy. Of return and liquidity issues.
And when it comes to like the pacing and how to allocate going forward, I think we need to do a little bit more on stressing, like, you know, if we're putting $40 million a year to work into private equity and there's a downturn, and what does that do to our cash? I think we'll be fine on liquidity, but just, you know, denominator effect, that type of stuff. So,
Brian, how much do we have allocated to private debt?
Like, we have zero allocation.
Oh, really?
Zero target.
I didn't know.
So, right now, we are 12.4% private equity. That is made up in large 95% of the money that I talk about all the time. We have 8.4 in real estate. So those are the big over allocations. The natural resources portfolio is the timber and the ag. We have some in infrastructure remaining. We have very little. It's Riverstone and private debt. We had an allocation there before, but we didn't add one in 18. So that's kind of where I think we need to.
Private debt is a relatively new asset class. I mean, when you look at us the last 5 years, I mean, it's really taken off a lot, but it surely needs to be considered.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Just like your mezzanine fund?
Pardon me?
Like your mezzanine fund?
That's part of it. I mean, there's part of it. There's, as Tony said, there's private equity firms who have raised funds specifically for these purposes. They could be senior. They could be mezzanine.
Yeah, the two big categories would be distress, so companies that have debt and have run into issues, and that debt trades at discounts, and there's all sorts of balance sheet engineering, whether within bankruptcy or not. That's kind of one area. And then the other area that I think people are running the most to is banks not willing to lend a lot in, say, oil and gas, some in real estate. And so filling that void are private credit funds. And so that's, I would say that's kind of the biggest area of newness. Because the demand is already there, and there's just limited supply. Is that Tony?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct.
That's right.
And I think opportunistically, there's folks that think there's distress happening or coming in commercial real estate, right? So that's not private credit, but that's more opportunistic. Securities that are liquid and traded that are now already traded in double digits. And so
the only thing I would add, Nick. Sorry. Go ahead, Tony.
That's okay.
Yeah, but
I'm just saying that strategy is not new. Private debt, it's been around for a long time. Again, because of where the banks have historically come in and out of the market, there's always been an opportunity for some kind of junior capital tranche, whether that's mezzanine, whether that's second lien, and there's been funds for a number of years that have targeted that. They've come in and out of favor depending on where rates are.
Yeah, I guess my point in mentioning it was while we can't invest our way out of this, we can add value marginally.
Yeah.
Right? And if we have a situation where everybody's excited, it's vetted, we feel really good about risk reward, but we're 9 months away because of a policy, like, are there other ways to think about that or be different?
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Yeah. No, I think kind of what we're doing now in the consultant is kind of step one to all of that, figuring out who we're using, what it looks like. You know, there's still kind of some governance. You know, how are we going to approve these investments? What does that look like? It's different than the public side. So we're, you know, once we get through July, we'll have a better picture of all of that.
Yeah, the advantage we have, one last word, is one, the demise of a lot of the banks out there. And, you know, that opens up a tremendous opportunity. And the other is the economic environment that we're in. And we're challenged. And this may last for a while. So, plus, private equity firms are also looking for capital to get rid of some of the positions that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And previously, they've been able to get bank lines. This time around, they can't. So they're also being stretched. So it's just a time where there is a tremendous amount of opportunity. There's a long runway. And it may last anywhere from 5 to 7 years.
All right, so moving forward, we covered a lot of some of the consultant search initiatives. We have in-person interviews with candidates for our internal senior investment officer position next week, so we're hopeful to kind of move relatively quickly there.
So what monthly meeting do you think you'll be back to us with kind of a recommendation on the consultant side?
July. So it's June 15th for the interviews, July for the recommendation report. So other IAC in June, we're going to review the public equity structure and what we're probably going to tweak the passive allocation compared to active and the manager weights there. And then we're kind of going through screening on the growth equity search to replace Invesco. We've had calls with, I don't know, 15 managers last few weeks on one to screen well, and we expect kind of coming out of the June IAC to issue the RFP to a select number of firms there. So bank situation, we had the slide a couple months ago. Just as a quick reminder, we didn't have a ton of exposure to regional banks. Most of it was under 40 bips, and it was in small cap equity and a little bit in fixed income. So just an update on the operating account. As a reminder, we use Texas Capital Bank to for our operating account and to pay our benefit out, you know, $28 million a month, kind of runs from our custodian bank, JP Morgan, through TCB to pay the pension payroll. Because of the turmoil, we've been trying to explore options on backup or new accounts to use for the pension payroll. We had a discussion with JP Morgan, our custodian. They do not want to do it. They're not willing to do it. That was disappointing. That and kind of some other reasons, we haven't made it, you know, done a custodian search in a very, very long time. So I think probably end of year initiative will be to do a custodian search and assess whether we want to stay with them or someone else that could help us on that and some other avenues that could be improved. We had a discussion with Northern Trust. They're willing to do the operating account and they can do it. We had a call with Bank of America this week to explore that avenue, and we're kind of in process there. And then we're reaching out to Wells Fargo as well.
You say you're thinking about changing the custodian bank or going out to bid on that?
Yeah, I think it's I think it was like 2009 or earlier the last time we did it. You know,
that's a major effort.
Yeah, I know. It's like,
I mean,
it's one of those.
That's going to eat a lot of time, so you want to prioritize that, and that may not be a high priority.
No, it's not, and that's why we're getting through some of this other stuff first.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, some of these discussions with JP Morgan, I think, kind of forcing their hand there, just because it's, you know, they have not been helpful where we need them to be helpful.
Okay, but Texas Capital, is there anything they've done that they've, from a service standpoint, that they've slipped or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Answer is yes.
Did you look at?
Well, we needed to set up a special account. It took months. Then we had an important wire that needed to go out. They knew that. We'd planned. They had everything, and they dropped the ball.
Hmm.
So, yes.
That's enough.
And we don't have the connections that we used to have. If we were to have a problem, I don't have the same level of confidence that I used to have that I could call someone and they would fix whatever the problem was.
Hmm. How about locally? Would we go to another local bank besides some of the bigger banks?
I don't think so.
What if we had a connection at one?
I think regional banks right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's showing some level of concern.
Yeah.
I think the overall concern.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about regional. I'm talking about, like, local, like Texas-based banks.
Like a Frost or something?
Frost, Prosperity, Third Coast, Independent.
Bank of Texas. The same story.
I think within this board, we know the senior management of Texas Capital.
Okay.
So we could follow if we could.
Okay.
Yeah. So have a reminder.
Ongoing there, but we're exploring options. So. All right, equity market drawdown looks kind of the same as it has the last few months, bouncing around, but relatively flat from last few months. I know we're running a little bit behind, so I'm going to move through some of these quickly.
Can I just ask one thing?
Yeah.
Does anyone on the board have, like, a here, now, immediate, just complete concern on this banking issue? And we don't want to gloss over it. It's in the news every day that is actionable. So,
I know we invest and sit on the board of banks. That's my day job. So we're pretty plugged in to banking. And we have tons of connections locally and regionally. And there are some issues, but it's very selected. So if you want to rely on those resources, we're happy to provide.
Okay. But, I mean, no one here is, like, they're convinced banks are going to fail, you know.
Well, I will say one thing. Is it idiosyncratic or is it systemic?
I
got to
look those words up. I'm not.
I mean, is it bank specific? Is it bank specific or is this like a roll, like a domino effect?
Well,
that it's going to have like a problem.
The sudden rise in interest rates is a systemic issue.
That's what I'm saying.
And, you know, it affects everyone in sort of the same ways, and then people have unique circumstances.
So So if we see increased, will we see more cracks? I don't know.
So what I'll tell you is, so you have Silicon Valley, Signature, Silvergate,
okay,
and Republic that have failed. Okay. PacWest and Western Alliance are the next tier of banks.
Yeah.
And PacWest was started by our firm. And so our founder is the chairman of PacWest. And what I can tell you is the FDIC is in there daily. They do not want that to fail. And they have suggested that, you know, they find a partner, basically. And they've got an internal rule kind of right now that they don't want any more failures. They don't want to have to take over banks because it has been idiosyncratic to crypto slash venture and liquidity-related reasons for runs on those banks. So can I say, do I think other banks are going to fail? I don't have that conviction to say that. It doesn't seem that that is happening. It seems that deposit outflows have slowed. The data would suggest that too. But you're absolutely correct. When you have rates up 500 basis points in 12 months, I mean, that is system-wide. That's not particular to those banks. But it doesn't feel like, from the read that we have, there's going to be another wave of failures, to the best of our knowledge.
Okay, so if anyone...
Good question. I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, and then it sounds like there's a service level issue with Texas Capital.
Mm-hmm.
We'll follow up afterwards on that and
yeah,
try to make some connection points there. So, okay.
All right. So, ended the month with $1.925 billion in AUM, $36 million in benefit outflows, and gain in other income of $134 million. Looking at the public market performance, we are up 7.2% year-to-date on the public portfolio cash, 8.8% in global equity, 5.4% in EM, and then fixed income's up 3.7%. If you look at the three-year number, which is probably more indicative of what we expect going forward on public equity, that outperformance level of 60 basis points is kind of what we've seen on a rolling basis for the most part. You know, it's a small number percentage-wise, but that 50 to 60 bips adds, you know, $4 million a year in alpha to that portfolio. So most of the outperformance kind of in fixed income is duration and structure of that portfolio compared to the benchmark, so that worked out well for us.
Those are good numbers.
Yeah, Brian.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, come on, I can go back, okay?
Okay.
We're going to show the highlight reel, a few more highlights.
Okay.
That it's important to note that we have a 6.5% hurdle rate. Okay, so
mm-hmm.
That's the rate at which, in order to make forward progress, we have to exceed it on a return. 3 years is a relevant measurement period of time to draw some level of conclusions, directional conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
So in 3 years on the portfolio we want to have, okay, so this is two-thirds of our actual portfolio. The other third are these legacy private investments that we have exceeded the hurdle rate. The index on a three-year basis has come slightly short. So if all we did was the index and we were all this portfolio, we would be losing ground a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Had this been our entire portfolio for the last 3 years, we would have gained a little bit of ground. Okay, that is very, very, very worthy of acknowledgement. And this is the kind of thing, once again, year to date, last year, you know, there's volatility. Once you come with three years, you see we had, you know, incredible off market, second half of 20, 21, 22 down, 23 up and bumpy,
mm-hmm.
and who knows. And so it's worth acknowledging this is what we want to get to, and it's the material portion of what we have. It's just not the complete picture yet, and that's what we're driving towards in liquidating the privates.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, move forward to the safe reserve dashboard. Net outflows averaging $9.3 million per month. As I said, kind of with the money that we held back, we've extended the runway through June of 24. We're at 138 right now compared to the target of 173 with 73 in cash. On the 73 in cash, we should be good on that amount kind of through Q3.
absent of any proceeds coming back. Already talked about allocation a little bit. So on the review plan going forward, today we're going to talk about the timber portfolio. And then next month we'll have Hancock, Manulife, we still call him Hancock after 2 years, come in person to talk about the ag portfolio. And I think there'll be a lot to talk about there, kind of given the water situation in California and then the snowpack this year and kind of what, how that's affecting our properties out there. Any other questions on the portfolio update? All right. Are we going to BTG? Or are we doing
other stuff? We're going to move item C11 ahead of the BTG.
Okay.
So, John, can you pull up the presentation I sent this morning? This is not in your materials that Melissa sent. I decided, when I was thinking about how to explain this situation to you all, I decided in the middle of the night that I needed to put together a presentation. So I did this morning. I apologize for typos. Nobody's reviewed this. and I emailed it to both Michael and Mark, since you're not in the room. But there's just so many dates in here that I thought a picture might be helpful. So we've talked a lot at a lot of different meetings about the requirement in 2024 and 2025 to hire this independent actuary. This is in section 2.025 of the statute that reviews the most current valuation and comes up with recommendations on how to get in to compliance with the guidelines and the guidelines and the funding level in the Texas government code. So this is really where we are now. The 1/1/22 valuation is in hand. That's what we received last November. The next valuation that we're going to receive will probably be around the same time frame, November 1st, 2023. It actually could be a little bit earlier, I'm hopeful, but let's just say since the last 3 years we've gotten it in late October to early November, I put November 1st, 2023. The statute has dates that say not later than these dates, and I'll just go through them quickly. So not later than July 1st, the PRB has to select an independent actuary. So the PRB selects the actuary. The contract is with DPSP on that. Not later than October 1st, the actuary has finished their report, their analysis, and makes recommendations. And then not later than November 1st, a month later, the board has to adopt rules to implement recommendations to solve the funding guidelines and the amortization within the guidelines. Not later than December 1st, the PRB sends a report to the legislature, and then the legislative session starts January 14th, 2025. We've always recognized that that time frame between October, November, and December wasn't workable. There's no way we can compress these huge decisions into a 30-day period. So we always recognize we'd probably start early and give the board more time and the actuary more time to develop recommendations. But this was kind of the guideline. A couple weeks ago, I had a conversation with the City of Dallas's CFO. And based on that conversation, I've added two dates to that timeline here in red. And the first date is February 16th, 2024. And I've put it in order how it falls into the timeline. That is the last day for the city to add a ballot question on for the May 2024 election. And that election is May 4th of 2024. And the reason I'm telling you that, and the reason now this has changed what I'm recommending to the board is in the conversation with the city, they indicated to me their intention is to have a ballot question on that November 2024 ballot for the ERF plan, the employees plan. Because on the employee plan, they fall into this FSRP guideline issue with the PRB, which basically says they also need to be within 30 years to fund. ERF is currently 76% funded, but they have a 50-year to fund number. So they need some changes as well. So I was surprised that, and I know in the ordinance for ERF to change their plan, the board has to approve it. It's a three-part process. The board has to approve it, the city council has to approve it, and the taxpayers or the voters have to approve it. So they plan to go in November of 2024.
Do you know what they're going to ask for? I mean,
I have no idea what they're going to ask for. They're still working through that. But I didn't want, I was concerned about a ballot question on ERS going before we even start our process. So my recommendation to the board is we start now. So here's a new process that I'm proposing. And so, again,
the, all of this last night in the middle of the night.
No. I put this together in the middle of the night. So, you know, after the conversation with the city, I started thinking about it and thought, well, we need to get ahead of it. And I told the city I didn't like the idea of them solving ERF in isolation of the DPSP needs. So, that and the city does recognize they want to move the timeline of us up first, but they really don't want to start. They don't want to get the independent evaluation until May 1st, 3 days before the ERF election. And then they want to come up with recommendations and do the whole process ahead of their budget, which totally makes sense. That they and I like the fact they want to build it into their budget. But that's just not going to work. So I've talked to the PRB to make sure they would be on board with this process, and they are. We worked through their council and Josh and I, and we've developed a memo of understanding on, because it actually gets very complicated on what does the PRB do and what do we do and the timeline and everything. So we've come up with an MOU. One of the things that I had to do was make a draft of the RFP, so I've done that, and sent it to the PRB yesterday for their review because, again, it has both of our logos on it at this point. We contract with this firm, but they select the firm, so it's really kind of convoluted how it works. So my proposal is we still have our current valuation in hand, but we start the work based on that. So we would issue the RFP in May. The PRB selects the actuary early July, and then the work would start really once we finalize the contract. The independent actuary would start replicating the Siegel work. And what they need to do is they need to basically take our very complicated benefit system and set it up in their actuarial system and then run everything through and see if they can come up with the same actuarial valuation as Siegel. That's going to take 3 to 4 months, just that part, which is why I think we should start with the 2022 valuation. Then from there, I would have them make recommendations and present those recommendations to the board, all based on the 2022 valuation. And what that does is it gets us in the framework, starts us thinking about, you know, what are the magnitudes here, and then the official analysis will be based on the 1/1/23 valuation. I think they'll be able to start this work early because the liability side should be done, and it's just the asset side. But worst case is they don't get started on that until November 1st, and then there's dates on replicating that valuation, which should go much quicker because they already have us built into their system. They've already got all the assumptions. It should be really fast for them to do. And then the official recommendations would be based on that valuation. It would come to the board, and you would consider that, and then we'd go through. Is that clear? So basically what I'm asking you is, can we do this process twice? It will cost us more money. I don't know how much yet. My guess is $100,000, probably more to do this twice, maybe not that much. But this is the plan because I really think before the city, I would like for the city to know what we think our needs are while they're considering the Dallas employee needs as well. Are there questions?
Do the recommendations include solutions, though? I mean, how to fund, or just a number, or just what?
I would anticipate they would, I mean, so the recommendations are supposed to include changes to benefits, city or member contribution rates. So whatever they recommend, they're going to have to do it in such a way that when you put all those in and you cost all those recommendations, you get to less than 30 years to fund.
Yeah.
So they're going to be very specific.
Less than what?
Less than 30 years to fund, and we're currently at 68. So it's going to be a big number.
Ridiculous. I mean, like, I'm just so confused because it just seems like such a ridiculous process because we're not the only ones. There are other cities that are there was a person that was speaking on behalf of the PRB, and everybody just moaned because it's not just us. No other municipalities or little or funds, they're not going to be able to do this. Do you know what I'm saying? To the degree, if we're doing it because we need to demonstrate to the city how.
So we are a little bit different. So yes, the reason that ERF is having to do this is because they fall within the law, the FSRP guidelines. They have now had 2 years, over 30 years to fund. So they have to be in compliance with that by 2025.
To be fully funded in 30 years.
Right. So that is the rule they're under. It happens to coincide with our rule. Our rule is specific in our statute. So I don't know what's going to happen if you don't meet the PRB guidelines, and frankly, I don't know what happens if we don't meet our statute, but I think ours is a stronger requirement than.
Yeah, the way I look at this, first of all, Kelly, I really, really applaud you and on being proactive on this. I just can't say that enough. We have to be people that are taking friction and noise out of the system in terms of this process. And in a way, like, I think what you're saying is these are a bunch of technicalities, okay? You've seen good purposeful things blow up because of technicalities. Oh, you didn't file this on time. You didn't do this. The law says that. And that's what people who don't want you to have the outcome you want, or they have other needs for the resources that we might be asking for, that's what they would throw out there. And that's why, you know, for years as a board, we've always talked about we need to make our shift really tight. The way I talk about it and frame it is we inherited a ship that was leaking, had bad navigation, you know, all sorts of issues, and we have made that a very solid vessel. Okay. The only thing we lack is enough fuel to take everyone to their destination. But in terms of what we've done and what we control, we've made this operationally sound. And it's staff, really, with, you know, help from all of us.
But to Bill's point, I mean, what are the recommendations? Recommendations.
So what it is that, I mean, common sense tells you external funding.
Exactly.
Okay. But we have to go through the procedural
things
to do that. And so what I see is other processes working alongside and complementary to this, like a communication process and like an engagement process with stakeholders that we're beginning to work. There's some work that's been done in the past, but they all work together, and ultimately they need to reconcile and merge. But we can't mess up by saying we didn't do the technicalities right. That's the way I look at it.
I think what Kelly's saying here is the actuary's recommendation is going to be that you're going to have to increase your annual contributions by fivefold or whatever it is. I think the city then will come in and say, well, we can possibly provide some additional funding through a number of the things that we've looked at over the years. I'm told that they're moving forward on it now that the election cycle's over and all of that stuff. Now, they've been saying that for a while. It's been very, very slow.
But it's going to be city manager, no?
The what?
It's going to be city manager.
The mayor was what drove the process that we had looked at, and we had given him a list of 8 alternatives of how to fund significant. Now, he'll probably tie that in with what they need for ERF as well, because that's always been the discussion. But we've had so much turnover down at City Hall. The CFO's gone. Tristan's gone. So I don't know what the continuity is going to be. That's the problem I have. I haven't dealt with any of the new people there.
There is one aspect of this that we want to talk about when we go into closed session, but there was no reason to do any of this in closed session. So, but the way that the RFP, the draft is that I have over to the PRB is I have built in part of the process where the board has an opportunity to ask the actuary to run different scenarios. Mm-hmm. So it's not just here's our recommendation, you must do this, but maybe you want to change a benefit. Maybe there's an increase in a benefit, so that if we increase a benefit, would that how much more would that need in member contributions or something like that. So we have built that in, at least in the draft.
Okay. So so we're not looking for a motion. You're just informing us this is generally the direction we'd like to head.
Well, no, I don't think there's a motion, but I want to make clear the board understands what's happening is that, you know, we've sent this draft RFP with this sort of contemplated dual work by the actuary. And ultimately, Kelly and I haven't talked about this, but I guess we would advise the board before we sign the contract about what it is to get an ultimate sign off on that. But we want to make sure the board's comfortable as we send out the RFP and get bids back and get PRB select someone to say that we're coming back to you with a contract that shows work in 2022 and 2023 and 2024. Make sure that the structure is acceptable.
And it sounds like you've been talking to the city, so they're on board. They know what we're doing. It's not going to be a surprise.
I've told them I don't think they like the fact we're getting ahead of the ERF, but that's okay.
Okay.
And they'll likely see a draft of the RFP as well before it goes out. So, I feel like we need to do this. And the other thing is this is not in our budget this year. So I think we have some capacity. It could push us over, but we'll let you know as we get closer to the end of the year.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're not asking for a motion, but this will lead to a motion at some point soon. And, I mean, I'd like to fully, my voice is that I'm fully supportive of this effort. Does anyone feel differently? And knowing there'll be a lot of discussion on this subject, and, you know, this is a very super preliminary, but it's directional. So
I think it's a good thing to be proactive on this.
Yes,
I mean,
I agree.
Yeah. I guess I would note, as much as we talked about a lot of issues over the next whatever the month is, next 24 months, I mean, this will become eventually the issue that, because this is really the solvency of the system is going to be dependent on whatever the resolution of the, you know, under the statute is of the funding issue from the city, you know, from where that's solved, so.
And any discussion of membership contribution increases is going to just resonate in such an ugly way, I cannot express it.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, thank you. We're going to go in closed session now.